Social scientists talk a lot about situated local knowledge and a type of knowledge that I also think is very important, but that doesn't mean that there is no role for biology or brain. I think depending on the host, different kind of tacit knowledge will also be sort of constructed and shaped. So I don't see them as necessarily mutually exclusive. So that's just my personal view. Now we'll move on to our next speaker, Professor Antoine Bechara. He's a Canada Research Chair in Decision Neurosciences and Neuroeconomics. He's a professor of psychiatry at McGill University. He has expertise in a number of areas pertaining to decision sciences. I just can't help but read one line that I read in his biography, is that he's studying a group of older adults and studying the factors, I believe, which render them more susceptible to falling victims to advertisement scams. So this is an interesting area in terms of decision making. And the title of his presentation is Decision Neuroscience, Risk Assessment, Choice, and Behavior. Antoine?
All right, great. Thank you.
Yes, we have to get the presentation up. This is yours.
All right, let's see. Okay. Well, now that you had Alain and Leslie, now me coming up, you're going to realize that we pretty much all talk about the same thing. We're all pretty much in agreement, except probably each one of us rearrange those different brain structures in a different way. They're all the same structures, except we arrange them slightly differently and probably use slightly different terms. But at the end of the day, you know, I think there are a lot of overlap in those ideas. And I'm going also, as the two speakers before me, make a connection between eating behavior and brain systems for addiction. And most models, contemporary models of addiction, they are dual. And Leslie already took a shot at this model, impulsive versus reflective, which is true. This is kind of a simplistic approach to the problem. But it's also true that people have thought about it. For example, the way people control their impulses and control their behavior, it's a little bit more complex, and there are different mechanisms that have different levels of complexities. But it's always easier to solve the easy problem. The complex problems are always more difficult to tackle. But many dual systems view argue for two systems. One of them we call it an impulsive system, but others call it a habit system. It has so many different names. And this involves, at least in part, an amygdala striatum-dependent neural system, which really promote automatic and habitual behaviors. And this includes the well-known mesolimbic dopamine system. And this is pretty much the system that has been studied for over 35 years now. It's a well-established and studied system. But there is more new on the blocks. There's another system, which is that prefrontal cortex system, which is really has to do with decision-making and the ability to control impulses and to exert inhibitory control on behavior. But I'm going to also suggest that there is a third neural system. I'm going to talk today about a third neural system that play a role in modulating or modifying these other systems, and then their implications for obesity and for eating behavior. And this is the early system, the impulsive or habit systems, and this was studied very intensely in animals, and it emphasized the role of a neural circuitry that includes the amygdala, the nucleus accumbens, and the mesolimbic and mesocortical dopamine systems in promoting the self-administration of drugs of abuse, and including nicotine and smoking. And this is another neural system which relates to the prefrontal cortex, and this is really came about from the more recent functional neuroimaging studies, which revealed that in addition, that activity within cortical systems that include the anterior cingulate cortex, the orbitofrontal cortex, also are important for the decision to take drugs and for the ability to control impulses and resist the temptations to use a drug. But there is a third neural system. So you've heard about the insula today, and the insula kind of pops up in a lot of those functional imaging studies. But for a long time, this structure has been ignored. And I'm going to try to highlight some of the role that these structures also play in these addictive behaviors. And a quick review of the history of this is that anatomically, the insula, you can divide it into two parts. The anterior part, it's more tuned to the viscera and the internal milieu, so it receives anatomical connections, mostly indirectly, that come from the visceral organs, whereas the posterior insula is more connected to the musculoskeletal systems and some of the sensory systems or the external environment. And I'm going to give you a short report on a few cases that we ran into where actually people who have a stroke and get damaged in that area, sudden changes in one aspect of an addictive behavior that they have, in this case, it's smoking. People were addicted to smoking. All of a sudden, the addiction stops and it ceases. And this is a review of a single case here. Nathan was a right-handed male who lost interest in smoking after suffering an ischemic stroke at age 28. Now, we're 10 years after the fact. We're interviewing him, 38 years old, and he was articulate and insightful about his medical and smoking history. So he started smoking at age 14, but at the time of his stroke, he was smoking more than 40 unfiltered cigarettes per day. So that was a very heavy-duty smoking. But then Nathan smoked the last cigarette on the evening before his stroke, because after having the stroke, he woke up and he didn't have any urge or any intention to smoke a cigarette again. And when asked about his reason for quitting smoking, he said, well, just my body forgot the urge to smoke. So he reported that he felt no urge to smoke during his hospital stay, even though he had the opportunity to smoke. And he has not felt any urge to smoke since he quit. Now, you know, you ask, well, where was his stroke? This is middle cerebral artery stroke, one of the key areas, that we studied and we kind of isolated. It's really the insula. So the insula is damaged in this particular patient. So we went back to our patient registry. You know, this work was done at the University of Iowa. We have a lot of patients that we follow them up through the years who've had strokes, and we tried to look at those who had a history of smoking, and we tried to distinguish between two different kinds of quitting. There is a quitting because people get scared after they have a heart attack or they have a stroke, versus quitting, which is really with complete ease, like a switch being turned off. And this is what we call disruption of smoking addiction, in a manner similar to what Nathan was describing. And without going through all the details of all of that, it turned out that majority of the patients with insula damage, it's about 63% of them, at least in this sample, had a disruption of smoking addiction. But, of course, not every single patient quit. And the majority of patients without insula damage did not quit. But there are some of them also do have a disruption of smoking addiction. This is one of the issues that we're pursuing to find out why. And it appears there's a broader neural circuitry that is associated with this, with disruption of smoking addiction. But the insula, at least, it's one of those key regions. So by combining the patients with right or left insula lesions, the odds of quitting with the disruption of smoking addiction were about 136 times higher after a lesion that involved the insula than after a lesion that did not involve the insula. Now, one obvious question is, do lesions in the insula lead to a disruption of other motivated behaviors, like eating? And especially since we know from a lot of the animal studies that there is overlap between these systems that have to do with addiction, but also that have to do with basic motivational drives like eating. And the short answer is no, it's not obvious, and I will tell you why. Because in a follow-up survey, we asked patients several questions about their experience of any changes in their desire to eat, their enjoyment of eating, or the amount that they eat after their brain injury. And none of these patients with insula lesions who met the criteria for having a disruption of smoking addiction admitted any reductions in their desire to eat or their intake of food. And perhaps there's a good reason. It's because eating is a basic motivational behavior that is fundamental to survival, and it's probably not very advantageous to have a system like that dependent on one brain region. So it probably has multiple redundant systems. So remember that these strokes happen on only one side. So there is still another healthy insula on the other side. So it's conceivable that eating behavior can be bilaterally represented, or there are redundant neural systems to support it, so that it's more difficult to disrupt it. But we speculated that probably learned behaviors, you know, behaviors that are not so fundamental for survival, like smoking, like drug addiction, may be disrupted by this kind of damage. And in this case, we speculated that obesity may be, since it's a lot of it, it's learned, maybe obesity is one of those cases that can be susceptible to disruption by this kind of damage. So we don't have any data, because I personally never studied eating behavior or obesity before. I'm kind of starting to do that. But it's one of the questions that we are trying to follow. So this is, again, a diagram of the brain. It has all the structures, all the neural structures that you've seen before, except that they are rearranged differently, and the idea is that, you know, we talk about two systems, you know, an impulsive system that goes through the amygdala and the striatum, but there is a reflective system that has to do with the prefrontal cortex. The insula is a third neural system that really responds to homeostatic signals, homeostatic reactions, whether it's deprivation or food or drug withdrawal, or any homeostatic perturbances. Once the insula is engaged, then it has a capacity to alter the dynamics between these two systems. And the hypothesis we're working on is that once the insula is engaged, then there is a potentiation or exacerbation in the activity of the impulsive system, but at the same time, there is a weakening of the prefrontal system. So in other words, once the insula is engaged, it's just like pressing the accelerator in the car and disabling the brake. So it's a recipe for becoming more impulsive, and any attempt to self-control sort of goes down or breaks down. Some of the approaches that we're going to test those ideas is basically with functional neuroimaging approaches. We try to tap into, so for to study each system, you have to have some paradigms. People use different paradigms, argue about which one is better than the other. But we've been using a task called the implicit association task, and then it's really a task that reflects a certain automaticity in behavior. For example, in marijuana users, we use cues that are marijuana-related or not. We use, for alcohol, we use the alcohol cues as target use versus not. And now we started to use food as well, and people have high versus low BMI. And we've been getting consistency across studies that when marijuana users, for example, see marijuana cue, there is something automatic about their behavior. It's faster and automatic. It is picked up by activity in striatal structures. In this case, is the ventral striatum, but also the dorsal striatum as well. So there is a higher striatal activity on the comparable trials relative to incompatible trials in users relative to non-users. And we have similar paradigms to study the control part of the task, using go, no-go task, and we pick up prefrontal activity when people are attempting to control certain behavior. Now, what are the implications for this? Well, obviously, there are some of them are clinical in nature, which is really to target the amygdala, the insula anatomically. You don't want to target it by a lesion in it or even deep brain stimulation, but transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a relatively non-invasive technique, would be one approach to target one specific area of the brain. And this can be a way of using it to study obesity. But there are other approaches that we've been trying to look at, which involve probably neuromarketing. And this is an example of a fight going on about McDonald's selling a toy with their Happy Meal to kids. So, of course, they always sell the toy with the big Happy Meal. But it's a question, if you want to reduce obesity, what happens if you offer the toy with just half the size of that meal for the same price? So you can choose, you can offer a kid a choice between this or this. Why this condition may work? Again, there is a brain science for it. It goes back to dopamine, because this dopamine system has been shown that it has a common currency in the brain. That is, it converts food to food reward to dopamine, but also monetary reward, toy reward. All of that can be converted to dopamine. And this has been shown many, many years ago that different drugs get converted to the same currency, which is dopamine. But not only that, different kinds of reward get converted to the same currency, which is dopamine. And all kinds of reward get converted to the same currency of dopamine, even money, invaluable objects like cars and houses and so on. So if so, then could then the reward from a large-sized meal or high calories be substituted for a non-food reward? And there is a precedence for this idea. Something was used briefly in the addiction literature. It's called contingency management therapy, which is really to substitute drug rapport reward with monetary reward. And the question, we don't have a full developed business plan, but the idea is an idea, is that would something like that work? But of course, this will require collaboration with people from food industry and for marketing. So basically, on the neuroscience level, though, we still have a lot of homework to do, because we know that dopamine responds to reward. We know that different rewards get converted to dopamine. But we don't know if, for example, half a hamburger plus toy equal large hamburger. We don't know if they add up in that way. But it's something that we worth exploring. So this line of thinking then is different from the traditional medical model of addressing eating behavior and obesity from a metabolic perspective. Instead, it emphasizes a neuroscientific approach that explains the individual brain mechanisms involved in the decision what to eat or what not to eat. Thank you.
I just wondered if the potency frequency of the toe is equivalent to the foot, I guess that will also determine the final magnitude.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, exactly. So you can do these things behaviorally, but you can also do those neuroscientifically to see which toy is more potent than the other. What kind of non-food reward is the most effective? Yeah.
Any questions for Dr. Shah?
Just wondering, are there any preclinical models of the insula and the EDD in your area?
No, not that I'm aware of. Especially on eating behavior, I don't think. I don't think. See, insula was not on the map in the entire 35 years of research on the mesolimbic dopamine system. So I'm going to venture and say no, there are.
There's a lot of work by Balain and Dickinson from Cambridge.
On insula and eating?
Motivated behavior.
Yes, of course. These trial systems. Yeah, of course, there's overlap between eating behavior and motivation to drugs.
Other questions?
Psychologically, what does the insula do?
Our view is that immediate surge. It's not only our view. This is also what Greg have put heavy weight behind it. It's a key neural structure that translates whatever raw physiological signals triggered by homeostatic imbalance into what may be subjectively perceived as a feeling. So it's a translational structure into subjective feeling of an urge or craving or whatever you want to call it.
I have one question. You mentioned the role of insula ideally in relation to forecast. I might have misunderstood.
Forecast
behavior, prediction of the future. Now, there is another sort of construct, if you will, foresight, which is now being differentiated as a different entity than forecast. While forecast tries to predict a deterministic future, foresight is a general level of cognizance about the possibility of multiple possible futures. Now, this might be important, I believe Leslie has mentioned, the traditions of science or the prevailing norm sometimes determine what kind of knowledge will be produced. In sustainability literature, for instance, foresight is sort of deemed to be important because it prevents us from sort of locking into a certain way of seeing the future or a certain way of doing things. So I wondered if insula or any other sort of neurobiological sort of substrates had been studied in relation to foresight. It seems to be an important sort of human ability for sustainability, but also to prevent this kind of locking behaviors in any kind of discipline.
Sure, but now I'm going to have to take you to another life of mine, another research life, which is really has to do with decision making, somatic marker theory, and forecasting the future consequences of a behavior, which I think fits with what you're calling foresight. And the insula, yes, it's a part of that neural circuitry. So decision making and forecasting the future relies on a neural circuitry that has many key structures. The orbitofrontal cortex is one of them, but the insula is also another key structure, and at least in our theoretical formulation, is that it's kind of a system that holds representations of prior body states. In other words, prior experiences with reward and punishment. Those emotional or value experiences, they have a memory somewhere in the brain. Not a memory recalling a fact, it's just like a visceral emotional memory, are represented in the insula. And when you are forecasting future decision, you need to access those representations. So prior experiences with reward in punishment have a say in what your prediction of the future is going to be. So it's part of that neural circuitry as well. At least we hypothesize that it is.
So imaginations of the future cannot be detached from the sort of past.
Absolutely. This is actually, we published some very recent work on that, and there was a whole series of the book came out of a conference on that. Yes, there seems to be a lot of overlap between neural systems that, you know, that recap the past versus project the future. And also another little piece of information that we're running into is that time is sort of processed in the brain in relative terms and not in absolute terms. So, for example, something now versus something delayed, it doesn't matter if it's on the order of minutes or if it's on the order of years or months. So there is no an actual calendar to process the brain, but it processes everything in terms of this is first, this is second, this is third. Yeah.
There is also part of the human brain that is about creativity and shifting the course if it's not biologically adaptive anymore. In what you have been referring to is more in terms of forecast, predicting as a function of what the signals we have encoded biologically from the past. How could you, if you want to move from to these four sides, how would you connect those systems to those that are linked to creativity and kind of the part that allows us to be human?
How do we?
We'll come back to this afternoon.
Okay. All right, cool.
Thank you, Dr. Shara.
All right.